Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Steve Phillips, best-selling author and host of the Democracy in Color podcast, who examines Donald Trump's unabashed racism and American voters' long history of support for white supremacist political leaders. Mazen Qumsia, director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University, who describes the Israeli military's latest deadly offensive in the occupied West Bank. And Dr. Stephanie Woolhandler, distinguished professor of public health at Hunter College, who warns about the danger Robert F. Kennedy Jr. poses to public health if he's confirmed by the U.S. Senate as President Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On January 29th, Goma, a city of 2 million people on the eastern edge of the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, fell to the M23 rebel army backed by Rwanda. The streets were filled with dead bodies, 400,000 people fled their homes, and basic services have been cut off. UN aid agencies have warned of a major humanitarian crisis with shortages of food and water and hospitals overwhelmed by casualties. The M23 rebels have threatened to continue their offensive targeting the capital, Kinshasa, although analysts say this may be unlikely as it's 1,600 miles away. The origin of 30 years of conflict and the current fighting can partly be traced back to the 1994 Rwanda genocide, where some 800,000 people, mostly from the Tutsi community, were killed by ethnic Hutu extremists. When Tutsi-led rebels intervened to stop the slaughter, an estimated 1 million Hutus fled across the border to the DRC. This has stoked ethnic tensions among Tutsis in the Congo. Multiple UN reports have accused Rwanda of using the conflict as a way of looting Congolese minerals such as gold and coltan, which are used to make key components in electronic devices such as mobile phones, cameras, and cars. For over 2 weeks, some 48 Uyghur detainees in Thailand have been on hunger strike to stop their possible deportation. The Uyghurs are Turkic-speaking Muslims from western China who face intense repression. In Xinjiang province, Uyghur men face risk of torture, imprisonment, or disappearance. The Uyghurs, detained in Thailand for over a decade, began their hunger strike after they were given voluntary return forms, which they refused to sign, but Thai authorities required them to pose for photographs. A similar series of events in 2017 led to the deportation of 109 Uyghurs back to China. Thai officials have repeatedly refused to let representatives of the United Nations Refugee Agency visit the detainees. Members of the U.S. Congress are calling for protection of the detainees, as well as access to asylum procedures and adequate medical treatment. Rushan Abbas of the World Uyghur Congress declared Thailand should prepare for a tsunami of condemnation if the detainees are returned to China. As Greater Los Angeles wildfires were still raging, tenant organizers gathered to figure out the extent of rent price gouging when over 100,000 people were displaced and over 16,000 homes and other structures were destroyed. California Governor Gavin Newsom imposed emergency regulations against price gouging and rent hikes, but housing activists were concerned that these protections wouldn't be enforced. Reviewing online Zillow's LA housing database, activists found 700 rental listings that appeared to be cases of rent gouging. Applying lessons learned from Hawaii's devastating 2023 Maui fire, where rents spiked over 44%, LA housing advocates are calling on Los Angeles County officials to impose a rent freeze and eviction moratorium and to fund rent relief programs. Before the fires, the average rent in Metro LA was more than $2,700 a month. But after the wildfires destroyed entire communities, rents spiked 20% over 2 weeks. Tenant union organizer Alana Holt told In These Times magazine that inflated listings are likely just the first wave of rent gouging that will play out after the fires. She predicts that landlords will increase their harassment to force tenants who are paying below market rents out of their homes. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Donald Trump, who's only been back in the White House for a little over 2 weeks, has catapulted the nation into a major crisis. The twice-impeached convicted felon's pre-election vow to be a dictator on day one has proven true. He's violated the Constitution multiple times by recklessly attempting to freeze all government grants and loans, eliminating entire government agencies created by Congress, firing 18 inspectors general, mass firing civil servants without due process, and turning over access to the U.S. Treasury Department's payment system and sensitive personal data of every American to unelected billionaire oligarch and Trump's co-president, Elon Musk. Donald Trump's white supremacist beliefs, blatant during the campaign as he quoted Adolf Hitler and demonized immigrants of color, is undeniable in his first week in office, issuing executive orders to eliminate all federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, as well as revoking President Johnson's 1965 executive order that prohibited federal contractors from discriminating in employment based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Trump's racism was again on full display when he outrageously blamed DEI for the tragic plane helicopter collision at Reagan National Airport that killed 67 people. Your reporter spoke with Steve Phillips, host of the Democracy in Color podcast and best-selling author of How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. Here he discusses Donald Trump's unabashed bigotry, the long history of white racial resentment, and American voters' support for white supremacist political leaders.
To understand Donald Trump's place in the political universe, as and most importantly, the political power that he's been able to amass and the support that he's been able to develop, which I will mention up top, still not majority support in the country, but far greater than anybody would want to previously acknowledge. His support is driven by and really undergirded by white racial fear and resentment. This is a long-standing, as long as we've really had this country, that this was the essence of the Civil War, right? And this is the irony of this moment, that it was the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, who actually ran for president, talked about this nation being dedicated to the proposition that all are created equal, opposed white nationalism in the form of white people owning African-Americans and slavery. And now we have the current Republican president really trying to reverse and oppose all of that tradition. And so he rose to power as a champion and defender of white people and the white culture of this country. He was at 5% on the polls in May of 2015 when he first entered the race, when he first came down those stairs at his event. He attacked Mexicans. He calls Mexicans rapists and murderers, positions himself as the defender of this country's culture. He didn't attack Canadians, who are also have a border with us. It was the dark-skinned Spanish-speaking Mexicans to inflame white fears and resentment, and immediately shot to the top of the pack of the polls and has never looked back. And so that is what has driven his support when he was president, unapologetic defender, waxing nostalgic about Robert E. Lee, talking about fine people on both sides at a white supremacist rally where a young progressive white woman was killed. his whole being and presidency and political leadership. He got clear around the potential power of these attacks by going after Barack Obama's birth certificate, claiming that that black man was not legitimately a U.S. citizen. He saw how much that riled people up. So we should have seen this coming. And so what all he's doing now is delivering on what he's been promising for over a decade in terms of trying to make this country whiter again. I titled the Trump chapter of my book, How We Win the Civil War, Make America White Again. And he is aggressively trying to do that.
Steve, as we confront Trump regime 2.0, blatantly racist, every action seems to underscore the fact that Trump is a bigoted fool. I wanted to ask you, what are some of the things you recommend average people, listeners who are appalled about this obscene, blatant racism we see from the president, the highest office in the country? What's an effective thing we can do?
Well, I would say two or three things. We have always had in this country two different nations, most really in terms of context of the Civil War. So it's the 19 states that voted for Harris, but also the 2,000 counties that voted for Harris. For instance, Houston, Harris County in Texas went for Harris. Harris County is larger than 15 different states. So there's a level of finding and backing the leaders and organizations in those places. It's a very specific thing that people can do. So Texas Organizing Project does work in Harris County, Texas. People should like subscribe to their newsletters, send them money, support groups like that. There's a group in Arizona, Lucha, does work in Maricopa County, which was a county that Trump won, but we really should have. Get behind groups like Lucha, get on their mailing list, send them money. So those are some very specific things. And then encourage the leaders in those places to stand up unapologetically for an alternative vision and set of values within this country. As he's rolling back DEI, what's notable about all his attacks on DEI and all of this stuff is these are attacks on remedies. He has not, even as far and as radical as he is being, he's not saying there's not a problem with inequality. He's just saying these remedies are bad. We shouldn't look at these remedies. So we should reground people. Do we care about equality? Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, he talked about we are dedicated to the proposition that all are created equal. Are we still so dedicated? And I would start the dinner conversations, the neighbors, the friends conversations with that. There's profound inequality. Do we still care? And are we going to do anything about it? And then we can talk about what's the particular remedy. And so it remains the case that most people of color do see a lot of the racism that's out there and want this to be a multiracial democracy. And left out of the conversation is a lot of whites want this to be a multiracial democracy. And that's still the majority of people. But to the extent that the fight is not engaged and called out and people summoned to their highest and best selves, then we will continue to erode the margins that we have had.
That was Steve Phillips, host of the Democracy in Color podcast and best-selling author of How We Win the Civil War, Securing a Multiracial Democracy and Ending White Supremacy for Good. Find a link to his recent Nation magazine article titled The United States Has Always Been a Divided Nation and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Barely 48 hours after the Israel-Hamas ceasefire in Gaza came into effect on January 19th, the Israeli Defense Force announced Operation Iron Wall, a large-scale military offensive in the Jenin refugee camp in northern West Bank to defeat terrorism. Israeli attacks have since spread to other nearby towns. On February 3rd, the Israeli army used explosives to destroy 20 apartment buildings in Jenin as part of the military operation that has thus far displaced over 20,000 Palestinians. Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, declared that troops would maintain a permanent presence there once the military operation was over. Adding instability to the volatile situation in the Middle East, President Donald Trump said on February 4th that the U.S. should own the Gaza Strip, level the site, and develop it, explicitly calling for the ethnic cleansing of 2 million Palestinians from their homeland, while not ruling out the deployment of U.S. troops to Gaza. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mazen Kumsia, a Palestinian activist and director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University. Here he talks about the escalating Israeli attacks in the northern West Bank, his expectation that the offensive will soon expand south, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's visit with President Trump, and growing international solidarity with the Palestinian people.
What Israel did in the Gaza Strip, they're repeating here: ethnic cleansing, destruction, arresting people, shooting people. It's starting here in the West Bank, and it's starting in the north of the West Bank. But throughout the West Bank, Israel has taken over all Area C, basically. That's 60% of the West Bank has become essentially off limits to Palestinians, and the settlers are rampaging in there with the soldiers and harassing anybody in that area. So it's tough. It's not easy. But it's still not as bad as what transpired in Gaza. But I'm sure it's getting there. And Netanyahu will be in Washington, D.C., meet with Trump. He will get a green light from him to do even more and get an update from him on their partnership in terms of the ethnic cleansing of the people of Gaza. Trump is already pressuring Jordan and Egypt to take Palestinians cleared out of Gaza to make nice beachfront property for settlers.
So far, Jordan and Egypt have said no way. Do you think that they will end up taking in people from Gaza?
Judging from history, they can verbally say no and under the radar do what is required of them, has happened in the past. Power and money speaks, so I wouldn't be surprised. Already, Egypt has hosted many Palestinians at a price that was taken from both the U.S. administration and also from the Palestinians themselves to leave Gaza. About there's estimates of 100,000 Palestinians who had to pay each $5,000 to leave the Gaza Strip during this war through the Egyptian borders.
They seem to be doing pretty much what they did do in Gaza in Jenin. Isn't it true that in Jenin, at least I read, that there's actually fighters in Jenin were actually able to unite across different groupings and have put up more of a fight against the Israelis than maybe is happening in other places? Is that right?
So the refugee camp in Jenin, the refugee camp in Tulkarem and in Nablus, and even here in Bethlehem where I am, refugee camps are centers of resistance for obvious reasons. These are people who were kept cooped up in a refugee camp for 76 years. Their parents or grandparents are refugees. So they're more likely to be resistors than this urban areas that don't have refugee camps or have fewer refugee camps.
Is it true that things in the West Bank have heated up in terms of Israeli attacks even more since the ceasefire was declared in Gaza?
The government decided to shift the forces here to the West Bank since the ceasefire. And of course, since things quieted down a bit on the Lebanese border, the Israeli army, which is stretched and doesn't have enough forces and doesn't have enough equipment, after much of it was destroyed in the attack on Gaza, they moved some of these units here into the West Bank. And so indeed that escalated the pressure on the West Bank.
A lot of times the Palestinians seem to be sort of standing alone and they're not getting support from the international community. But have any other governments made any statements?
There's close to 30 governments that now joined the struggle to label Israel, to call it what it is, which is a violation of the International Convention against Genocide. And Israel is now at the International Criminal Court and International Court of Justice. As far as Western governments, Germany, Britain, the U.S., these are colonial governments that are under the thumb of Zionism, and they're willing to wreck their own economy to continue to be partners in crime with the genocide that Israel is committing in Gaza and now spreading to the West Bank.
That was Mazen Qumsia, director of the Palestine Institute for Biodiversity and Sustainability at Bethlehem University. Find more news and commentary on Israel's war in Gaza and the West Bank by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. www.jewishfoundation.org. After his November election win, Donald Trump put forward a number of outrageously unqualified nominees who lacked any experience or skills for key positions in his cabinet. They included Fox News TV hosts, accused rapists, alleged alcohol and drug abusers, admirers of despots and dictators, a QAnon conspiracy theorist, and a dangerous promoter of anti-science views. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services, has for years led an international campaign promoting mistrust of vaccines, which are proven to have saved millions of lives. Kennedy, who ended his own independent presidential bid in August, threw his support to Trump in exchange for a pledge from Trump to give him the power to guide U.S. healthcare policy. During his Senate confirmation hearing, RFK Jr. demonstrated little knowledge of how the vast U.S. federal health system he would oversee works, and repeatedly lied about his past well-documented anti-science and anti-vaccination beliefs. Kennedy has been accused of contributing to a deadly outbreak of measles in American Samoa. After he visited the island in 2019 to discourage people from taking the measles vaccine, an outbreak followed, causing the deaths of 83 people, mostly children. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Stephanie Wollhandler, Distinguished Professor of Public Health at Hunter College, who talks about the danger RFK Jr. poses to U.S. public health if he should be confirmed by the U.S. Senate as HHS Secretary.
RFK says a lot of things. Probably half of them you and I might agree with, like, you know, let's improve Americans' diet, let's have them all get exercise. But half of them are totally crazy. Okay, but as a physician and as a scientist, how do we tell the difference between a good idea and something that's totally crazy? Well, we have to rely on facts and science. And RFK has shown a total disregard for facts and science. You know, he's still going around spouting the view that vaccines cause autism. There was one report a couple of decades ago that said it might cause autism. Not only were there numerous reports subsequently where scientists looked at it and said, no, that is not true. Vaccines are not the cause of autism. We're sorry we don't really know the cause, but vaccines are not the cause. That was very clear from the science that that original report was false. And in fact, it turned out that that data on the original report was partially faked, and the paper was actually retracted by the Lancet that had originally published it. So that's what the science said. You know, science can get things wrong, but we don't have a better way of telling truth from fiction. And we cannot advance public health without trying to figure out truth and rejecting the fiction. And that is what RFK has been totally unwilling to do. When information comes out that says, for instance, vaccines are not the cause of autism, he ignores that because he just chooses to ignore it. You know, I think the issues with raw milk was very dangerous at one point in history because it carried tuberculosis. That's not currently a problem. But right at the moment, we're dealing with the threat of a major bird flu pandemic. And even though we call it bird flu, one of the main animals affected by it are dairy cows. And until we know where this bird flu thing is going, if it's going to turn into a major pandemic for humans, or if it's going to be contained, we have no business promoting things like raw milk. Raw milk means the milk that has not been processed with heat to kill the bacteria and viruses in it. But here again, RFK has been totally oblivious to facts and science, that while you're facing a threat of a serious viral illness that's transmitted from cows, you probably need to heat your milk before you feed it to children and adults. He's been totally oblivious to that science, and that's the problem. Trump himself is totally oblivious to science. That's bad enough in Trump, but we're talking about the most important health official in the United States, in some ways the most important health official in the world, and Trump is nominating a guy who doesn't really believe in facts and science. And that's the real problem, you know, not his specific opinions, or he might be wrong about this or wrong about that, but that he has just shown that he has no real understanding of science and of facts.
Dr. Wollhandler, if RFK Jr. should win confirmation and become Health and Human Services Secretary, what powers would he have to influence public health policy across the United States that most concerns you? What could he translate in terms of his own belief systems, wrong or right, into our system of health care across the country that concerns you most?
I mean, one of the things that seems likely with the Medicaid and Medicare programs, given Trump's other behaviors, is whatever billionaire donors want, that's going to be government policy. And unfortunately, billionaire donors might, for instance, want the private insurance industry to totally take over Medicare and Medicaid. And I'm sure RFK is going to do that if Trump tells him to. I mean, Trump policies are basically based on whatever billionaire hands him an extremely large check and whispers something in their ear, his ear, about what he wants. So I think RFK has said, you know, President Trump's going to be my boss. I'll do what he says. And I think that means that we're going to see a healthcare system that operates in the interests of billionaire donors and not in the interests of the health of the American people.
That was Dr. Stephanie Wollhandler, Distinguished Professor of Public Health at Hunter College. Learn more about RFK Jr.'s anti-science views and the danger he poses to public health by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky and Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KXIR in Freeland, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.